You're listening to Amphibicast.
This episode of Amphibicast is sponsored by ExoTerra. For quality products tailored to your amphibian's needs, including everything from terrariums to substrate, misting, and lighting supplies, visit exo-terra.com or visit your local dealer. Welcome back, everyone. Thank you for joining me again. You're listening to Amphibicast. I'm Dandro Bates, your host, and I'm honored this week to have researcher Madeline Cochran, and we're going to talk about some very interesting stream dynamics and a very unique species of salamander. And I'm really looking forward to it. I know a lot of you have asked me about stream content and caudate content, and this seems the perfect opportunity to marry those things together. I ran across this paper by Madeline and gave it a read. It was very interesting, and she was kind enough to agree to come on the show, so we're going to talk about that. But before we get into that, of course, the usual stuff. I want to thank everybody for your support. Five-star reviews, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, whatever your favorite podcast player is, goes a long way. And if you want to leave a review with some nice, kind words, that helps as well, but by no means do you have to do that. And for everything else, if you want to support the show by becoming a patron, follow the link in the show notes to the Linktree. You can become a patron for as low as $1 a month, but the $5 a month tier, that'll get you a shout-out at the beginning of an upcoming episode. And you'll find links to the merch store. You'll find links to our sponsor this week, and you'll also find some affiliate links to In-Situ Ecosystems as well. So other than that, Madeline, I'm so grateful to have you. Welcome. How are you doing tonight?
Great. Thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, so I came across your paper, and individual growth rates and size at metamorphosis increased with watershed area in a stream salamander. So I read through this, and there's just so much to unpack. I'm really interested in caudates, and I'm really interested in streams. As I've mentioned to my listeners on the show, there's a lot of little streams by me that I fish regularly, and they're just such a unique environment. And I figured this was just a great opportunity to kind of expand on that and talk about a very unique species of salamander. So before we get into that, though, I was wondering if you could tell us about yourself. Maybe give us an idea of what your background is, how you started off with amphibians, and what led you to where you are today.
Yeah, so I imagine, like a lot of your listeners, I grew up just loving being outside and spent my summers in Georgian Bay on Lake Huron catching frogs and toads, but didn't really kind of know that I could study amphibians for a career until even after college. I think my most kind of sentinel experience was working in Glacier National Park here in Montana, where I currently live. But I was just a young, young 20-year-old at the time, and I got a field job working for USGS, surveying for amphibians across the park. And I just absolutely loved it. It was tons of backcountry hiking and catching frogs and toads and salamanders. And I fell in love with the place, but also just these really unique species that we were finding in some pretty amazing places. We had Western toads that we'd find up at, 6,000-7,000 feet passes. And just was so curious about how these creatures could survive in some pretty harsh environments. Kind of decided I wanted to go back to school. So went back to graduate school to start thinking about mostly amphibian. And actually for my master's, I worked with wood turtles. So reptiles too, but herps anyways, thinking about different environmental drivers to population change and different demographic rates. So thinking about what's influencing survival or recruitment for herps.
Often on the show, I talk about amphibians in the tropics, and I feel like they kind of get a lion's share of the attention, whereas a lot of the species that live in northern latitudes, I'll be honest with you, I really haven't covered that often. And if you don't mind, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about that, too. How many species of amphibians are in the northern USA, and that in the region you're in, Montana, Idaho, the Dakotas, like that northern part of the U.S.?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So it's kind of funny. Yeah, a lot of your listeners probably from the East Coast might not think we're up to snuff here, because there really aren't that many in the grand scheme of things. Like when I was working in Glacier, we predominantly only had three species, kind of one toad, one frog, and one salamander. There are You know, if you expand that out, kind of probably about 10 amphibian species in Western Montana. But it's certainly not nearly as diverse as the Appalachians or even as you move further west to the coastal parts of like Washington and Idaho. So not a ton, but we do have some pretty hardy species. So
what are the driving factors behind that? Just the harsh weather or what is it about that area of the country that limits the number of species that we have in terms of amphibian biodiversity?
Yeah, I think the biggest limiting factor is it's just really dry here. Like it's not a humid environment for an organism or group of organisms that really requires water to survive. So that's going to be kind of the biggest factor driving the biodiversity, low biodiversity here and higher biodiversity kind of in the Pacific Northwest or the Appalachians.
General question and then a specific question. Like first part, why study amphibians? And specifically, why study the species of salamander that you worked on for the paper?
Yeah, so part of that is a little hard to explain, right? I just kind of fell in love with amphibians from a really young age and have been lucky enough to continue to study them now as an adult. But I also do love that they're just such a cryptic group of organisms. Like we don't know a lot of their life history or a lot of their population dynamics. They're not as easy to study as a lot of wildlife, a lot of friends that study birds or other larger mammals. So they're fairly understudied, and that was appealing to me to try to understand a bit more and kind of equal out that equation with some other comparative groups of wildlife. And like I said, kind of with my intro story, they can thrive in these really harsh environments. And so that kind of piqued my interest of kind of what's going on there or how can we begin to understand the adaptations that they have to be able to live in those environments. And then salamanders specifically, I was really excited to work with Gyrinophilus porphyroticus for my PhD. I've always loved salamanders, but especially here in Montana, you see them rarely. So we have long-toed salamanders and some tiger salamanders, but you know, you can go years without getting a sighting. And so to have this opportunity to work in New Hampshire and the Appalachians, kind of on the northern extent of their range, where there's just thousands of them packed in all these headwater streams, this really like intact ecosystem was really exciting. And I have always been really into plethodontids and think that they're super interesting. The fact that they can breathe cutaneously through their skin, and the spring salamanders, Gyrinophilus porphyroticus, are one of the biggest plethodontids, one of the most long lived. And so just, it was this fortunate and rare opportunity to work in a really cool system, that I was excited about.
What constitutes a stream habitat? And what makes it unique?
Yeah, so streams are often contrasted against like lake or lintic environments. So stream habitat sometimes in freshwater research, we call them lodic environments. So they are going to be faster moving water compared to lakes, right? They often consist of stretches that are riffles. So the fastest moving water, turbulent places, followed by pools, so these slower moving sections of stream. They are really connected to upstream environments. So they kind of connect terrestrial environments to lake or ocean systems. They also are really, have like really high dissolved oxygen. So because they have small surface areas and interact with oxygen or with air and oxygen a lot, they have really high dissolved oxygen, which is important for a lot of the organisms that live in them. So invertebrates and salamanders and the like. And yeah, so they're this unique ecosystem that maintains unique biodiversity that isn't found in lintic or lake systems or terrestrial ecosystems that they're adjacent to. And they kind of also follow this natural continuum from kind of the highest portions of mountains or where water starts to collect on a landscape. There's just these ephemeral or really intermittent habitats that only have water collecting for certain parts of the year in the wettest part of the year. And then as you move down the landscape, you have water building up as it moves across the land, and you have more perennial or large rivers that can even stratify to some extent like lakes. But the headwater ecosystems I have largely worked in are again kind of understudied, and you know, they make up the vast majority of total stream miles in the US, for instance, but are given relatively little attention because they aren't those big rivers kind of dumping into the ocean that we have a lot more information on than smaller kind of intermittent systems.
How much seasonal variability is there in a small stream? Like, because I know that once by me, we had a lot of rain here over the past few weeks, and a lot of the streams swelled up, and parts that weren't normally flowing had flow, and it's just very different now than it was a few weeks ago, where we had a long period of cold and we had no real significant rainfall. How do those factors affect a stream habitat between, you know, rains, snow melting, severe weather, drought? How do all those things affect the stream environment, and are there consistencies throughout the year?
Yeah, no, that's a really cool observation and totally true. Streams are really dynamic systems and change a lot from day to day and across a year. So they are going to, the organisms that live in streams are going to have to and have adaptations to deal with really, you know, big floods that come on rapidly, especially, you know, in a lot of parts of Appalachians or New England where I've been working. So these organisms have figured out how to withstand these big flash floods that come on quickly, and then also withstand times of the year when they're completely desiccated and organisms move into the benthic habitat at the bottom of the stream, the stream bed, or even the hyporheic. So having to move into this area of the stream that interfaces with groundwater, so even deeper than kind of the gravel or cobble that you see. You can see like from hiking up the stream. And so it really is this cool dynamic system, both temporally and spatially. And so I think streams have a lot in common from stream to stream, but then there's also a lot of variability across locations too, with what organisms are going to have to deal with in that particular location.
So I'm going to try and pronounce it again. I'm going to do my best because, like I said, I don't normally pronounce binomial names in casual conversation. All right, Gernophilus, that was the genus, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
Porphyriticus.
Porphyriticus, okay. Yep. So Porphyriticus, what constitutes the ideal stream habitat for this species?
Yeah, so Gernophilus porphyriticus, or just northern spring salamanders, is fine too. They live across the Appalachian Mountains, so all the way down to Alabama, to even further north than where we were in New Hampshire, up into Canada a little bit. But they live in streams, and they also live in seeps. But they are a plethodontid, so they do require water to survive or to breathe through their skin. So kind of one of the big questions we had in this paper, right, is kind of exactly what you're getting at, is like, what is the perfect stream environment? And one of the things we did find is that it does appear that those most hydrologically stable environments are best for the spring salamanders. So environments that aren't prone to desiccation or drying out are going to be most optimal, at least for growth and size, and then it appears for population growth as well for spring salamanders.
Like, are there temperatures, dissolved oxygen levels, are there any specific water qualities that make a stream habitable for them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they require high dissolved oxygen to survive. because they are breathing through their skin, which is true of most headwater streams, at least pretty intact headwater streams that have high dissolved oxygen, is certainly true in the White Mountains where I worked. As you can imagine, you have more human influence. Those levels could go down. And yeah, so similar to most ectothermic or cold-blooded organisms, they're going to generally be able to grow faster at higher temperatures and not grow as quickly in cooler temperatures. So for instance, in New Hampshire, where it's snowy in the winter for a good portion of the year, over half the year, these guys are hunkering down in the bottom of the stream and just riding it out with really low metabolic rates, kind of in not like an exact torpor, but not moving or eating much. And so they can survive in cool stream temperatures and to up to, relatively high, but there is kind of a happy medium for stream temperatures as well for salamanders and specifically springs.
Is that an environment that is important for all plethodontids? I mean, I I'm not much of a caudate person, so I don't quite know too much about them, but are they all dependent on this type of stream environment?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the plethodontids in the Appalachians, I would say, there are a lot of plethodontids in the tropics that have very different life histories and don't require stream environments, just live in humid rainforests and can persist in terrestrial environments, kind of cloud forests without being in a stream or a seep, but certainly in kind of New England or most of the Appalachians, you're going to find plethodontids in streams or caves or seeps, like these moist environments that are fairly similar to where I was in New Hampshire.
Yeah, I was thinking of Bolita glossa down in South America, which is like the complete opposite of the Appalachian species.
Yeah.
It's an interesting anomaly. Yeah, I'm just curious. I mean, while we're talking about natural history, can you give us the natural history of the species and the life cycle?
Sure, yeah. So northern spring salamanders have a biphasic life history. So they have a larval stage and then an adult stage. We think that spring salamanders deposit their eggs in the summer. Unfortunately, even after four really extensive field seasons, handling thousands of these salamanders and flipping thousands and thousands of rocks and looking for them, I've only come across just a couple egg masses, and we don't see a lot of gravid females, even some, but not a lot. And so a lot of their reproduction is a bit of a mystery, but we think they lay eggs in the summer, and then the embryos hatch in late summer. And those eggs, like I said, are likely laid in really deep underground recesses and streams and seeps, kind of under rocks. And then once those larvae hatch, they remain in the streams, in the gravel beds usually, or beneath stones or logs. And when they're larvae, they have gills, so they're restricted to aquatic environments. But as they metamorphose, they absorb those gills and are able to, that's when they start respiring cutaneously through their skin. And so they're able to leave the stream in humid conditions, especially at night, as adults to feed or disperse, as long as, they'll always end up back in the stream when conditions aren't conducive to them to breathing outside of the stream. And both stages eat a lot of aquatic and terrestrial insects. They also are really known for eating other salamanders. So we've seen Geranopholis with other Geranopholis in their stomach. They also eat a lot of two-line salamanders in our system. And so kind of a voracious predator. And they're really large too. I might've mentioned that before, but one of the larger plethodontids that we have, if not the largest. and pretty cool organism. They're usually considered the top predator, aquatic predator, in streams where fish are absent, and have some predators for spring salamanders are going to be like brook trout or snakes, but they are also a predator for other salamanders in the environments that they live in.
It's a beautiful species. So, I mean, I'm looking at some photographs of them on Google Images, bright red. Do they develop this coloration? Does it become more pronounced as they grow older and mature, or is it something that's seen like right after metamorphosis?
Yeah, I would say they get darker in color, like the older they are, definitely. I mean, when they're larvae, as I'm sure, you know, or most people have seen, salamanders are kind of the grayish color that blends in a lot with kind of the stream background. But then, yeah, as they metamorphose, they become this really nice orange or salmon color, almost, yeah, like pinky at times. And yeah, have some black dotting as well, but really, really beautiful organism for sure.
Yeah. I mean, the Appalachians have so many, like the biodiversity of salamanders is so incredible. And this is just another species. It's so beautiful. And it's funny because there's so many of them, like you said, they're just so cryptic that you never see them. I mean, I work on a 95 acre plot and I think I've seen maybe two salamanders in the past 5 years, and it was awesome when I did, but the biodiversity is incredible.
You have to work for it.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you credit the intense biodiversity in salamanders in Appalachia on the east coast of the U.S.? Do you attribute that to anything specific, or is that just the way that things evolved?
It's kind of both, as my understanding goes, the way things evolved, but also just the habitat conditions are really conducive for the life history of plethodontids specifically, but other salamanders as well. So the humid environment and kind of the diversity and from the top of mountains to the bottom provides a lot of different niches for salamanders to occupy.
And the absence of fish was another thing that interested me. So are they apex predators because fish don't prey on them, or are they apex predators just because there's no fish there to prey on anything else?
Yeah, kind of the latter. So they aren't apex predators when like brook trout are present, but they are able to subsist in these stream environments kind of beyond which brook trout can survive in. So they kind of hit their happy medium in medium to small reaches that brook trout are unable to get to, or they dry out too much for brook trout to be able to survive in, or other fish, I should say. But yeah, so those are where they'll be apex aquatic predators anyways. But there are some overlap in our system and across their range where they do coexist with fish as well.
Do we know if any of the introduced species, like you mentioned brook trout, like brown trout and rainbow trout, does that affect them at all in terms of being, because I know like brown trout eat everything. I don't know if that has a role in their population numbers as well.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't totally know, just because we don't have any kind of in the system I worked in, but I would expect that a brown trout would eat a spring salamander if given the opportunity. So if those ranges did overlap currently or at some point, I would think that it would be a predator of spring salamanders. Yeah.
Yeah, where I am, the brown trout stocking went down significantly. There's a trout stream that's managed by New York State out here. It's an amazing piece of property. And the story I heard was they stopped stocking brown trout because what happened was the brown trout were just feeding on, I think, like all the fry from the hatchery, all the rainbow fry. And at the end of the year, they did whatever they like. Again, I'm embarrassing myself. I don't know the exact term, but they, for lack of a better word, shocked the pond. And this one massive, like 15-pound brown trout just floated to the surface, and apparently it had been eating all the fry. So, I mean, obviously there was more than just that one trout, but like now, like they don't stock brown trout in any of the streams here because of that. So, I don't know, when I think of brown trout, I just think of like an, you know, ecological disaster waiting to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, most of the brook trout we find are not huge, and so the biggest risk for spring salamanders are going to be when they are in that like larval or early stages, early years of their life. But almost all of the adults are above the gape limitation of fish or trout in our system, and I would imagine most systems just because they get to be pretty big. So they do influence the behaviors and survival of larval individuals. And we found in this research, the growth rates of salamanders as well. But kind of once you get too big for the fish to eat you, you seem to kind of be able to largely ignore that threat.
And they have a long lifespan. How many years do they live?
The salamanders?
Yes.
Yeah, so this is a really cool component of our research. We didn't really know previous to our work on this in the last couple of years. We knew that in the southern Appalachians, Gerontophilus were metamorphosing around 3 to 4 years of age. But the work that we did, the research, long-term data set we have for salamanders suggests that they're not metamorphosing in our system until 7 to 8 years old, which is kind of insane. And some of our salamanders, the biggest of the salamanders we caught in this across this 8-year study period, could have been as old as 20 years old, which is pretty wild for a salamander, you know, in its natural environment and not, you know, in a zoo or something or someone's home.
Interesting. How does that factor in with the normal variations? Like, are there variations, meaning, let's just say for argument's sake, you have a perfect year, and we'll get into this when we discuss the paper, but just, you know, just to kind of rough start the discussion, let's just say that you have several years of poor water quality, and then that's followed by several years of, or let's just say poor conditions versus good conditions. Will the salamander's reproduction rate improve consistently year by year? Meaning, like, all right, if let's just say, I'm sorry if I'm like making a mockery of this, but say a larvae hatches out in the year 2000, and for the years 2000 through 2005, the conditions are poor, and then it metamorphoses out at, say, 5 years of age. And then one that hatches in 2005 has good conditions and then metamorphoses out 2 years later. Is that a dynamic that's happening?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. And actually, no, according to our research, we didn't find that the spring salamanders in this system were changing their timing to metamorphosis across these environmental conditions. So across watershed areas, which we used as a proxy for hydrologic intermittence. So somewhat surprisingly, you would expect, kind of as you suggested, that, you know, in good growth conditions, well, it could kind of go both ways, your hypothesis. But, you know, in good growth conditions, perhaps you want to delay your metamorphosis to get really big, because your size is going to correspond to your fecundity or your ability to have more more larvae or better reproduction. Whereas, like in a bad year, perhaps you just want to get to metamorphosis as quickly as possible. As it's been demonstrated with a lot of pond breeding amphibians. Otherwise, if you don't get to metamorphosis in a really bad year, there's a high likelihood you're going to die before you can reproduce. But at least across the variables, the environmental conditions that we saw across the system we were working in, we saw there was no change in timing of metamorphosis across conditions. So salamanders in intermittent reaches weren't getting, on average anyways, to metamorphosis earlier than salamanders in kind of hydrologically stable or intermittent reaches.
Interesting. Well, walk us through the paper. Okay, individual growth rates and size at metamorphosis increase with watershed area in stream salamander. Walk us through it from start to finish. I mean, number one, well, just before we get into that, though, I do want to discuss the area that you selected for the site. That was the Hubbard Brook Experimental Forest. Why did you choose that site for this study?
Yeah, so the Hubbard Brook Experimental Forest is home to one of the world's most influential long-term ecological study sites. It's where, for instance, acid rain was discovered. It's a really cool community of scientists from all different backgrounds and interests. And they, kind of most importantly for me, have collected data on how discharge variability has changed across really small headwater streams for over 50 years. So we have a lot of data from big USGS gauges on larger rivers to understand flow dynamics over time, and in like the Pemigewasset River is the big stream in New Hampshire where I work, but we don't know a lot about that variability you were talking in smaller headwater streams. So Hubbard Brook has been able to capture that across multiple sites in this little pocket of the White Mountains in New Hampshire. And so that was a big reason why this was a good place to go to ask these kind of questions. And then it's also where my advisor, Dr. Winsor Lowe, has been working for the last decade or so, collecting data on spring salamanders. So I had kind of multiple years of going back to the same streams, surveying in the same way, capturing tons of salamanders to be able to get at more long-term questions about population dynamics and life history variability that is really challenging, especially for a lot of grad students, you know, who you only have 3 or 4 years of data collection. But I was able to do my own 3 or 4 years of really extensive data collection at Hubbard Brook, but then also add that to other work that other grad students had done to kind of better inform our understanding of what's going on with spring salamanders in this part of their range.
Interesting. So it seems like you got really the perfect type of environment to conduct this type of research then, right?
Yeah, I feel really lucky. I mean, it's a very intact system, so which is good for the salamanders, obviously, and a lot of the biodiversity. But you know, it's different than a lot of other parts of their range, where spring salamanders have other influences that are you know, really dictating some of their population dynamics. But it's somewhat of a pristine environment that we had an ability to go back to streams. So we went back to 9 different stream reaches 9 times each summer. And so flipped like thousands of rocks and hoped that you find a salamander under each rock that you flipped, and were able to individually mark each of those salamanders so that we could track if that salamander survived till the next survey, or even the next year, or the next year. Some of these salamanders you were capturing, you know, 3, 4, 5 years after they were originally captured, which is just pretty amazing for such a cryptic species that can be really hard to study. And like I mentioned earlier, we don't know a lot about some of their life history. So starting to tease apart a little bit of what's going on was really special.
How do you mark an individual salamander and then identify it years later?
Yeah, so early on in this study, they were using elastomer, so kind of this color dye that you put just under the skin, and you can use different color combinations to individually mark a salamander to know its ID. What I was using for the last 4 years was really small pit tags that we would put just under their skin, so make a small incision and slip it under the skin, and then you can read a pit tag reader, kind of like they would use if your dog gets lost or something and gets to the pound. They can read a microchip and tell you what that number would be. Similar concept for how we mark salamanders.
Interesting. And well, I'll tell you what, let's get into the paper. I'll let you discuss the details there. So tell us about what you found. What is the relationship between watershed area and reproductive success and size and metamorphosis? Just walk us through the whole thing.
Yeah, definitely. So we used watershed area as our proxy for hydrologic intermittent. So again, at really small watershed areas, you would expect flow to be more ephemeral or intermittent. And at larger watershed areas, it's going to be more permanent and hydrologically stable. And so we found that spring salamanders had lower individual growth rates at smaller watershed areas, so at those intermittent environments. And correspondingly, we also found that salamanders at those intermittent environments had smaller sizes at metamorphosis. And then these kind of scaled up from the individual level to the population level to contribute to reduced population growth rates in those environments where flow was intermittent. And we kind of think that this is largely being driven by the fact that the larger you are at maturity, the greater fecundity that you're going to have over your lifetime.
What is the correlation between the size of a body of water and the size of the animals that live in it? Is there a universal percentage, or however we would want to, I guess, describe the mathematics to it? Because, I mean, if I go fishing in a small creek for a native brook trout, the native brook trout are really, really small, maybe like 6 to 8 inches, maybe 7. Whereas the larger rivers and larger creeks, they're much larger. Is there some sort of universal adaptation among vertebrates that dictates what size is appropriate based on the size of a stream environment?
I think mostly that's going to come down to just like the physiological limitations of living in those low flow environments, right? And the physical limitations too. So, as long as an organism has the plastic kind of capacity to have different variable sizes, the only sizes that are going to be able to survive in environments where flow is limited and there's just less water, for instance, to move around in and consume resources and kind of forage and stuff. So only the individuals that kind of either are small or stay at a small size are going to be able to survive in those small environments. Yeah, so I would say that's somewhat of a universal truth. Of course, there's a lot of like interspecific variability across species. And then even within one stream, right? Like even if you think about a cross section of a stream, like for instance, spring salamanders are going to occupy in general, especially the adults, kind of the foul leg or the middle of a stream, kind of the deepest portions. They're the most dominant salamander often in the environments that they live, and they're going to push out other salamander species to the margins or kind of the wetted edge or even the terrestrial habitat. So there's going to be variability in size of salamanders across kind of just a cross section too, with often the largest in the middle and smaller individuals as you move into more like dry environments just across a cross section.
Is there a specific number that you might expect to find? Like, let's just, I mean, again, arbitrary number, but let's just say that you have what you would consider a small stream with smaller individuals versus a large stream. Like, is there a direct correlation between a certain size and the number of salamanders? Like, is there a, how would I put this? Like, is there a ratio of water to salamander that equals reproductive success? I guess that's the only way I could put it.
That's an interesting. So I didn't look at like population abundance specifically in its relationship to watershed area. I would imagine that the environments that are hydrologically stable, so those kind of those reaches above like brook trout and a lot of those other, yeah, like fish predators, but below kind of where the streams are intermittently drying out is going to be where you have the highest carrying capacity. So the most salamanders are going to be able to live in those kind of happy medium environments. I didn't measure that or test that directly, but I would imagine that would be the theory that I would operate under.
I see. And the Hubbard Brook Experimental Forest, what sort of variations did you encounter over the period that you were doing the research? Were there droughts? Were there heavy rains? Like, can you just give us an example of some of the weather conditions that might have been variables throughout the course of the study?
Yeah, definitely. So So this study started in 2012 and then wrapped up in 2021. And we had a lot of environmental variability across that time, both on the dry side, so stream drying in late August and September, and then also some pretty big, almost hurricane-like events, big flood events that happen more in the late spring or early summer, but can happen anytime throughout the year. So across that time period, we did experience some pretty big, big floods and droughts. And then that is going to feel different to a salamander, depending on where they are across this like habitat continuum or stream continuum that we're talking about as well. We do have a paper that is coming out here in American Naturalist that specifically looked at stage-specific demographic rates based on hydrologic variation. So this paper that we're talking about mostly looked at spatial variability in like population growth rates and individual growth rates, but we also did kind of tease apart that temporal variability across the last decade and try to understand what vital rates, so like survival or recruitment into the larval stage, which of those were most affected by big floods or big droughts, especially as we're expecting those to only increase more with climate change.
How much of an effect does the presence of man-made conditions affect this type of system? Because I mean, by and large, so many streams and rivers are a source of everything, a source of transportation, power, et cetera. And there's things like weirs, there's dams, there's man-made lakes and whatnot. Do we know how that affects this dynamic as well? I mean, does that change anything outside of what you encountered at Hubbard Brook?
Oh, it certainly does, right? So as I mentioned, Hubbard Brook is a pretty pristine, it's all national forest land that's protected. So unless there's experimental manipulations done at this forest intentionally for research, we don't have, you know, we have weirs to collect discharge data, but we don't have a bunch of dams that are changing the flow dynamic. So I would expect that a lot of the patterns that we see in this, from this study to be seen in other places where there is more human influence. So for instance, if you're going to have more dams that are kind of damming up flow, I would imagine that organisms above those dams that are benefiting from that water being held up in the upper reaches of streams longer than it would have otherwise would benefit from that hydrologic stability. But perhaps some of the organisms or salamanders downstream, those reaches might be more intermittent than you'd expect under a natural flow regime. So definitely, I think that, you know, as always, humans complicate things in so many ways, and it's ecology. So there's always so many interactions that are hard to like tease apart. But I think a lot of these concepts would hold true, at least in kind of like the physiological or physical mechanisms that we're talking about.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it never occurred to me until I started really looking into it, but how significant man-made presence is when it comes to bodies of water. Like all the large bodies of water that are out where I live, with the exception of a few of them, are essentially man-made. I mean, they were not dammed, but the weirs were constructed. And it's funny because people will walk around and have no idea that this thing was it's completely artificial. So that's a dynamic that really always interested me. So I mean, there is the potential for it to have a positive effect, though. That's what you're saying for this species, right?
Oh yeah, I don't think it's all negative. It's just sort of a pros and cons, right? We also draw a lot of water away from streams for personal consumption or other consumption, right? So it's just going to in those cases, you're going to have less water in the stream for organisms, or if you're radically changing the temperature or pollution, of course, that's a totally different story. But I don't think all man-made structures are necessarily bad, no.
What role does behavior have in relation to metabolism, and is that affected by different stream conditions?
Yeah, that's a really cool question. So, you know, these salamanders are ectothermic, so they're cold-blooded, right? So in general, the environment dictates kind of their relative speed of metabolism, right? So on cold days or when the water's really cold in the winter, for instance, like they're not able to move around as much or forage as much. And then in the summer, as we found, their growth rates greatly increase. Their metabolism is able to increase as temperature rises. But specific to kind of our question and the lack of water, so we know that plethodontids require moisture to breathe for that cutaneous gas exchange, right? So we would expect that in these really dry environments, salamanders just aren't able to have as much gas exchange, which is going to reduce their metabolic processes. And could be contributing to what we're seeing, right? These lower growth rates and these smaller sizes at metamorphosis. Definitely.
What are there any other variables that are possible catalysts for change in population dynamics? Like when you finished the study, what additional questions did you have about this type of situation and other things that could affect it?
Yeah. So, you know, even in thinking about growth rates, right, and the mechanisms driving the trend in growth rate that we saw, certainly it could have been this reduction in metabolism. It also could have been, or could, you know, be all of the above too, of course, but could be increased crowding. So as stream reaches dry out, you're going to have these pools separated from kind of the flowing water. And organisms like salamanders that are in those pools are going to experience crowding and really suboptimal growth conditions, you know, higher stress, less resources for each individual. Those pools are also going to have less inputs of alloctonous or organic material that generally enter from floods and get flushed down the flow or the path of streams. And when that flow is lost, there's going to be less organic matter to be the base of the food web, right? Support invertebrate production. And so that could also be just decreasing food availability for salamanders and reducing their growth rates and subsequently size at metamorphosis as well. Yeah, those are just a few mechanisms that I think are very feasible for this system.
Are there any of the factors that would reduce the amount of dissolved oxygen other than, I mean, obviously slowing down the flow of water and heat and things like that, but pesticides, any other factors? Like, is there anything that would deplete the oxygen in a stream that's otherwise moving consistently?
Yeah, certainly like humans could. Also, you know, like what you see in lakes when you have a lot of like algae grow, you know, you have more organisms, more plants that are consuming or like producing carbon dioxide and are going to reduce the amount of oxygen in lakes, like for fish, for instance. So you don't see that as much in streams just because the water is flowing and isn't stagnant, but yeah, mostly at least in Hubbard Brook and a lot of other similar headwater streams, dissolved oxygen isn't a limiting factor. It's just really like it's one of the highest rates you'll see anywhere in these really small headwater streams that just have so much interface with the air.
Interesting. So it's like it's. This is like the perfect species. It's completely perfectly adapted for this.
Yeah, they definitely seem to thrive in these hydrologically stable, but headwater stream like dynamic environments. You know, they are long lived, right? So an organism that takes 7 or 8 years to get to maturity, as climate is increasingly variable, you do worry about those really long lived species because they're less able to adapt just mostly because of their long lifespan and longer kind of, not quick generation times. But yeah, at least at Hubbard Brook, some evidence that we're finding that their population is declining over time, corresponding to times when there was more hydrologic variability, although overall the population is still pretty abundant. And their like population growth or lambda over the last decade, like on average, has been around one. And they do show some demographic compensation. So different vital rates are able to kind of absorb some of the negative impacts of certain environmental stressors better than others. And so it's not like a total negative decline in every way. And so their population can rebound in years when there isn't hydrologic variability. But yeah, hopefully it doesn't become too variable for them in the future.
Now, your study was 9 years, right?
Yeah, 8 years of data. And we had had a little bit of a 2 year gap in between, but
okay.
8 years of data collection. Yeah.
I mean, it's a very lengthy study. Were you able to establish patterns that you could predict the future of what's going to happen to the population?
Yeah. I mean, I think that you can certainly predict out that, in these kind of intermittent reaches at the highest reaches of the watershed are going to be the most prone to population decline in the future as climates get drier and we see more variability. And so salamanders kind of at the edges of their kind of local range even are going to be most challenged and going to rely on the stable environments that still exist. So I certainly think that's a prediction that should hold true into the future. I mean, it's kind of a little hard with climate change just because it's hard to make predictions about kind of environmental magnitudes of environmental variability we just haven't seen, right? So this idea of a 100-year flood or a 100-year drought is just changing, right? We're not on the same trajectory that we were the last 100 or 200 years. We're having new normals, and so a 100-year flood is not the same thing as it was 10 years ago. So you know, there's always that caveat, but I do think that my research suggests that while this population is mostly okay at the moment, you do worry looking to the future with more variability if there's going to be a tipping point for their kind of population level response.
Yeah, that was what I was curious about. I guess it's a matter of finding out it's a bad pun, but like the weakest link, so to speak, because so many of these species have the potential to be put in a position where they would be, I mean, realistically, a stream habitat is can be very, very easily messed with by people. So I often wonder about certain species that are fairly well established and that aren't necessarily in any type of danger, but there's always those certain factors that can affect the environment in such a way that under the right circumstances, or which would really be the wrong circumstances, but under those circumstances, it could pose a substantial amount of damage to a species. So, I mean, this is why I find research like yours so interesting, because it sheds light on naturally occurring phenomena that I guess in the long run we would have to be cognizant of when we make good decisions in terms of how we manage watersheds.
Yeah, and just I think what I found and feel confident in is that one bad year isn't going to cause this population to, you know, go extinct or even be threatened. But if we have a string of really bad years, either, you know, big floods or big droughts, I do think that's when we need to start worrying and thinking about ways to maintain a population or give them the minimum habitat requirements so that they can persist beyond those bad years.
And earlier when we were talking off air before we got started, you mentioned that you had some new research that was coming out. I was wondering if we could take a little time and talk about that, because this was really interesting. This was really exciting. And I think you said you're going to kind of develop this more. Could you tell us about what your newest project is going to be and what you're looking for in the immediate future?
Yeah, definitely. So our new research, we're trying to understand how different demographic rates are influenced by big floods or droughts. So we were trying to understand if, for example, larval recruitment, so new individuals entering the population, is that vital rate just as susceptible to a really big drought as is adult survival, or are there some rates that are better able to absorb those environmental challenges? And so what we found is pretty interesting. So we found that flooding, so big floods, at least across this 10-year period we've been talking about, reduced adult recruitment, so the probability of larvae metamorphosing, but didn't have any effect on larval recruitment. So for some reason, young of the year individuals are able to get into the bottom of streams and withstand even really big flood events. But adults seem to be queuing into the rising limb of a flood or something, and thinking I would probably be better off, you know, surviving as an adult. And perhaps that's part of the reason we saw that trend. We also found that adult and larval survival declined with flooding, but interestingly wasn't affected by drying. So it seems like survival in this system is more changes more with flooding and not drying. Although if you kind of combine all of these rates, we found that annual population growth rates declined with both flooding and drying. And so even though there was variable directions of kind of response, overall, in general, more hydrologic variability decreased population growth rates when looking at this temporal data set. And then as I kind of alluded to, we did find that those population growth rates did decline over the study period. So from 2012 to 2021, we did find a declining trend, which is unfortunate and does suggest perhaps that more frequent and intense hydrologic variation contributed to this decline in lambda, which would suggest that more environmental variability in the future could have some negative demographic consequences in the future.
What is it about flooding that would cause so much damage? I mean, is this environments being washed away, eggs are being lost? Like, what is it about a flood? I mean, like the drying, I get it's they lose their habitat, but with flooding, what is it that ultimately causes so many problems for them?
Yeah, no, you're definitely, I think, on the right track with your mechanisms there. So you would expect that in really big floods, some salamanders, especially smaller ones perhaps, that are less able to withstand the force of floods or water, the shear forces, would get swept downstream, some of which, at least in invertebrates, could be catastrophic drift. So kind of getting flushed so forcefully downstream that they lose their writing ability and can die that way. We'd also expect that flooding could flush out a lot of that allophthonous or like organic material that's so important for these organisms in pretty like nutrient limited environments. So it might be another contributing factor for reducing like prey availability and resource availability. I think both of those are possible.
Is a flood, does the population damage after a flood, is that something that happens immediately? Like, let's just say for argument's sake, you have a week of torrential rains and it causes flooding and then everything kind of goes back to normal for a few months. Does the damage to the population occur during the immediate event, or does it kind of become a ripple effect where it continues to deteriorate after that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I wish I had like an exact answer for you. I think that would be a really good graduate project, right? Really good two different hypotheses. My the way we estimate these rates and do this modeling, I was just looking at annual changes in rates. So because we have to capture so many individuals to get a good idea of what their recapture rate is and what their survival rate is, it's hard to do that on like smaller timescales than a year. But I think, you know, my guess would be both of those things are probably true. And teasing those out would be a really interesting study and challenging, but worthwhile to understand, like, which is the perhaps the bigger driver there of population change. And, you know, certainly affects, you know, to a young larvae, it'd be really interesting to see what kind of cascading effects that would have on that individual for multiple years, if possible, you know, across the lifespan of that individual.
Interesting. Yeah, it just, I mean, I get it. I get that, that flooding would be a problem, but you always think about, I guess that's just kind of a bias. I guess you think you automatically assume dry is the worst. That's wild though, that it affects them both ways, but in different ways. Interesting. So, I mean, we're kind of winding out to the end, but I kind of wanted to ask you where you see your research going in the future. Like, let's just say for argument's sake, we follow up 5 years from now, 10 years from now. What are some questions that you'd like to find answers for with regards to salamanders or anything else that you're looking to do research-wise for the near future?
Yeah, I would definitely hope that I am continuing to do research to understand the impacts of environmental variability and climate change on freshwater organisms, especially amphibians. So not only kind of quantifying what has been done or what is currently happening to those species, but then, you know, how can we use that data and those models to inform predictions and inform management for kind of essential things that those populations need to withstand environmental variability. I enjoy research, and I've been doing a lot of Bayesian modeling to understand these different demographic trends, but I definitely want to stay grounded in how to keep that work applied and keep it relevant to those of us that just love amphibians and those of us that are managing amphibians or other wildlife populations. And continuing to support other researchers and kind of enthusiasts alike.
With regards to long-term management of watersheds, what role does this type of research have when it comes to determining policy? Like, let's just say for argument's sake, somebody says, all right, well, we've got this system here. We want to do XYZ with it. How much of this type of research factors into that when people consider how to manage a watershed?
Yeah, I would hope that that those biologists that are managing forests or different lands often don't have the ability to go out for 8 years and, you know, really intensively study salamander, stream salamander populations like we did. And so they can't, you know, they can't do this themselves, and that they're relying on us to come up with the methods and the models and the results to inform kind of what is happening in these populations and what are some of those drivers of the population, so that they can then use that information to make management decisions about, you know, flow regimes, as we were talking about, you know, with dams or kind of water use, like what is the absolute minimum that a lot of freshwater loaded species need to survive, especially in late summer, you know, when water is already limited. So informing some of those basic physiological needs and ground truthing that with actual results from real populations.
Yeah, I just think it's important. It's important stuff. You know, I mean, I've beat the topic to death, but like, you know, the fisheries management has always interested me. And like, the more I find out about the way that fisheries are managed, the more I'm interested in other things like this, like the more I'm interested in the way salamander populations and frog populations and insects interest me a lot now. There's a biomass in insects in stream situations. So it's an amazing body of research. It's kind of become like one of those things that I've become more and more interested in as of late. You know, if you were going to pick one species to study though next, is there any species of amphibian, salamander or otherwise that you'd like to work with?
That's a great question. I've kind of always had a dream to work with tailed frogs. So, here in in Montana, we have Rocky Mountain tailed frogs, and it's just the coolest thing to go out into some of these streams and flip over a rock and see a larvae just suctioned onto the bottom of a rock, or see some of the adults with their little tails. And so I would love to be able to ask some of these similar questions, but here in my backyard. So thinking about an organism that, as far as I know, is pretty poorly understood. But yeah, thinking about how tailed frogs survive in some pretty dynamic stream environments out here in out west.
Are the streams and rivers out west in your area, Montana, there, are they that different from springs and streams in the east? Are they that different, or are there some commonalities to them?
Well, there's definitely commonalities, and the flow is start small and moves to bigger, and you're going to have the same kind of groupings of aquatic invertebrates at higher reaches compared to lower reaches, kind of the shredders versus grazers, et cetera, ratios, although different species. You have kind of the larger rocks higher up in the continuum and smaller rock sand, in the larger rivers. But as far as humidity goes and like the plant diversity, it is pretty different. And just the glacial inputs in a lot of these streams is pretty interesting too, and changes the dynamic with how much silt is getting into the streams out here in Montana, for example.
Yeah, that's like, people always ask me, like, where do you want to go if you could go anywhere? And I'm like, you know what, like, I've said places like Costa Rica, Panama, whatnot, but like, I still, like, I would love to see like some of the, like the rivers of Montana, like, what's that famous river that's out there? There's a few famous rivers. I'm trying to think of the one about like up by Missoula.
Yeah. The Clark Fork is, pretty well known, I would say or the Flathead is also like a pretty well known river system.
I think that was it.
Yeah. We're pretty blessed with, some beautiful, beautiful rivers, very abundant with fish. If not amphibians, at least we have a lot of fish here.
Yeah, it's beautiful country. I mean, I've only seen pictures, but I'd love to see it one day in person.
Yeah, it's definitely stunning. I recommend coming out if you get an opportunity, definitely.
Definitely. Well, Madeline, I want to thank you so much for coming on and discussing this paper. It was really enlightening, really fascinating. I was wondering if you could share any links or any resources that the listeners might want to check out if they want to find out more about you or more about your paper or just more about the species or research in general. Where could they find it?
Yeah, I'm not super social, or I'm not super active on social media, if I'm being really honest. But this paper is available to, it's open to the public. So if you just go to Google Scholar and type in individual growth rates at size at metamorphosis increase with watershed area in a stream salamander, it'll pop up and you can read all of it and enjoy it. You can also send me an email if you're curious about any of these topics that we talked about. Right now I'm at madeline.cochran@montana.edu, and I always love feedback and questions. So I guess those would be two places you could look.
Well, thank you so much, Madeline. I really appreciate you coming on, and I'm so glad we got a chance to talk.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure. So, all right, everyone, again, I want to thank Madeline for coming on and talking to us about this topic. Caudate stuff is interesting to me more and more every time I do a show about it. It's kind of getting under my skin, and I'm really enjoying the caudate episodes. So, yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed it. And I've got more good stuff coming up on the way, so make sure you stay tuned. I've got a lot of fun, interesting topics and amazing guests. So make sure you stay tuned, and I'll catch up with you all again next time.